This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington, and here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You cannot imagine the number of people who just stormed the Kapmanuel building premises welcoming President Ousmane Sonko and his deputy Jomai Fai. The crowd was so huge, and the crowd was also so huge at his residence in Chitekir Gurgi in downtown Dakar.
That was reporter Alpha Jallo in Dakar on Senegalese opposition leader Ousmane Sonko being freed from prison. Details coming up. Also, the future looks dim for millions of children in Ethiopia's Tigray region. And Sudan's civil war shows no signs of coming to an end. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Senegal's top opposition leader Ousmane Sonko and his key ally Bassirou Diomaye Faye have been released from prison ahead of the presidential election later this month, triggering celebrations across the capital. Reporter Alpha Jallo in Dakar tells me his supporters were pleased hearing Sonko was free.
Yes, exactly. Yesterday in the evening, not very late into the night, about 11 p.m., news reached everywhere that Sonko and Jomai have been released from jail. You cannot imagine the number of people who just stormed the Kapmanuel building premises welcoming President Ousmane Sonko and his deputy Jomai Fai. The crowd was so huge, and the crowd was also so huge at his residence in Chitekir Gurgi in downtown Dakar. Sonko was escorted by some of his allies and the security forces, and he was drove to a hotel in downtown Dakar. And Bassirou Diomaye Faye was just cheered by the crowd, and then he just said that they were very happy that they came out of prison and that they promised to hold a press conference in the next few hours.
Does this release follow President Macky Sall's decree to exonerate political prisoners, including hundreds that were arrested in the violent protests last year?
Yes, exactly. This is all part of President Macky Sall, amnesty. Last month, President Macky Sall called a national dialogue, and during the national dialogue, he said that he's going to an amnesty so that Mr. Sonko, his deputy, and all the political detainees will be released from detention. So even before the release of Sonko and Bassirou Diomaye Faye, Hundreds of political detainees who were languishing in various prisons across the country benefited from the amnesty.
And as you were reporting, Alpha, Senegal's image as a pillar of stability was shaken when President Macky Sall tried to suspend the elections. So is the political trajectory of the country back on track?
Yes, people are saying that not back in track, but in the past couple of days, when the Constitutional Council rejected President Macky Sall to hold the election in June, and also when President Macky Sall convened the electoral body and wanted to announce a new date, and then the Constitutional Council announced a different date. Later, both the president and the Constitutional Council, they agreed, to hold the elections on the 24th of this month. Well, that's a little bit have restored the image of the country. But, there's so many contestation on the electoral process. As we speak today, the Supreme Council is examining a complaint lodged by the Democratic Front for an inclusive election. They've lodged an appeal to the Supreme Court protesting about the legality of the electoral process. And this move has been spearheaded by the Senegalese Democratic Party, PDS. As you know, that the Senegalese Democratic Party candidate, Mr. Karim Wade, the son of the former President Ablaye Wade, his candidacy was rejected by the Constitutional Council.
That was Alpha Jallo reporting. In the latest from Dakar, Senegal's top court has upheld the decision to hold the election on March 24th, rejecting an attempt by disqualified candidates to cancel the date. The court said the issue did not fall within its purview adding that the Constitutional Council had full jurisdiction in electoral matters. It should be remembered that President Macky Sall postponed the February election and tried to push it back to December at the last minute, sparking a crisis and deadly protests. He then reset the date to March 24th. The future looks dim for millions of children in Ethiopia's Tigray region as years of disruption, conflict, displacement, drought, and disease have left families without livelihoods and basic necessities. Getacho Redda, president of Tigray's interim regional administration, says more than 91% of the population in the region is exposed to the risk of starvation and death. And regional statistics suggest that more than half of all primary age children in Tigray are not enrolled in school. Magnus McFarlane Barrow, founder and CEO of Mary's Meals, a Scotland-based aid agency that supplies food and other assistance to school children around the world, just returned from a trip to Tigray. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the situation.
It's a really alarming situation. Over 4.5 million people there are currently in need of urgent food aid. 1 million of them are still displaced after the terrible civil war there. That war took the lives of around 600,000 people in Tigray. It destroyed their infrastructure. You know, it left the economy shattered. And on top of that, they're in the third year of a drought, meaning that less than 50% of the fields that would normally be planted are currently planted. So already today, people are dying of hunger in Tigray. I spent time in hospital wards full of emaciated, acutely malnourished babies, talking to doctors who talk about the rate of malnutrition having tripled recently. I spent time in displaced camps where whole groups of people, 220 people living in a former school for 3 years now, saying that all of them spend every day begging. That's the only way they are surviving. A number of their group, 7 people, in fact, in that place have died of hunger in the time that they've been there. So it's an awful situation. And the most concerning thing is that all their predictions are it's set to get worse in the coming months. And there's real fear of this becoming a much bigger crisis even than it already is.
And what is your organization, Mary's Meals? What are you all doing in this region to help?
So the work of Mary's Meals is all about providing daily school meals for the world's poorest children so that we meet their immediate need for food and at the same time we enable them to come to school and gain their education. So globally, we feed around 2.4 million children every day in the world's poorest places like South Sudan and Haiti and so on. And in Tigray, that was our program before the war, doing the same thing. And during the war, that program was put on hold because all the schools were closed and we had to adapt our work to emergency responses. And now we're back to the same thing, feeding children in school. We feed about 45,000 children there every day. And we're urgently looking to expand that program because all over Tigray, children right now are dropping out of school because of hunger. Less than half of the children of school age in Tigray are now left in school. And that situation is getting worse week by week. So we urgently want to roll out our program.
Now, you have launched a worldwide crisis appeal to spotlight this deepening humanitarian crisis. What so far has been the international response?
People have been amazing, really incredible, very generous donations being made already. And we just hope that continues because we're able to translate those donations into new schools being fed very, very quickly. And we're in the happy position of just, you know, doing that and working with our amazing partners there right now to start organizing those expansions only made possible by those donations we're receiving. But as I say, there's less than 5% of the children in of school age in Tigray are receiving school meals. Our work, you could say, has only just begun.
That was Magnus McFarlane Barrow, founder and CEO of Mary's Meals, speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis. Sudan's brutal and devastating civil war shows no signs of coming to an end. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says it is paramount that diplomacy be escalated to get a ceasefire and a negotiated settlement, and that citizens who so far have been sidelined should be at the center of any resolution. Siegel points out to me that so far, regional powers seem to see the conflict as an opportunity to expand their influence and create a de facto vassal state in Sudan.
I am concerned about Sudan further escalating, and we're seeing growing involvement by regional actors, especially from the Gulf, primarily with the UAE and these outside actors really don't have Sudan's stability or citizen participation at heart. And so I am concerned that we're on a track where Sudan will be a focus of regional competition through proxy forces. So it is very important that we escalate diplomacy, get to a ceasefire and a negotiated settlement. As part of that settlement, Sudanese citizens need to be at the center of any resolution. They have been sidelined in this conflict between two military actors neither of which have popular support. And so there is a coalition of civilian actors. There's a long tradition of active civil society groups in Sudan. Really, the focus needs to be elevating their posture, their presence at the negotiating table, so that we can find a solution that's going to be in the best interest of Sudanese citizens.
And you are right. Sudan's civilian movement has been scattered. Political parties are struggling to form a common platform. Since the civil war broke out last year, a succession of efforts to bring the warring parties to the neighboring table has failed. The United States, Saudi talks in Jeddah, Egyptian initiative, and repeated efforts by the African leaders.
It's going to require sustained engagement, for sure. And the longer the conflict goes on, the more complicated it becomes. And we can fully expect that there will be fragmentation on each side of this conflict the longer it goes. And as external actors, vie to control different proxy leaders and proxy forces. And so I do think it's important for the United Nations to reassert its role. I think the troika of countries that have long been key supporters in Sudan, so bringing in the United States and European interests who don't have sights on seizing Sudanese territory or threatening Sudanese sovereignty, I think they need to be brought back into a greater extent so that you have honest brokers and that, again, are willing to elevate Sudanese citizen interest. And I can't emphasize that enough, that it's citizen interests that have been sidelined in this conflict. This isn't a civil conflict in that you have two parts of a population fighting each other. These are two military factions that are fighting each other, and citizens have been the bystanders. And so we need to reverse that, get citizens back at the forefront of these negotiations, and really then need to, after reaching a ceasefire, walking back the political interest of those military actors and helping them find palatable exit strategies so that Sudan can be reintegrated and maintained as a inclusive and sovereign state that is representing Sudanese citizen interest.
And lastly, Mr. Siegel, Sudan has become a cockpit in which the rising powers of the Middle East seek to gain advantage over their rivals. This outside influence, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, as well as relative newcomers such as Iran, Qatar, and Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, all these countries involved to gain advantage.
Absolutely. Sudan's strategic location, bordering the Red Sea, but bordering Africa and the Arab world, makes this Sudan conflict far more serious and far more consequential than just an ordinary civil war, as devastating as that is for the country itself. But it definitely ramps up the stakes And you have regional powers who see the conflict in Sudan as an opportunity to expand their influence and to create a de facto vassal state in Sudan. And so it is a very serious threat that will have long-term implications for the region.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, speaking to me by phone. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Al-Shabaab militants stormed a hotel in Somalia's capital in a siege that lasted more than 13 hours and left 3 people dead and 27 wounded. The attack began last night at Mogadishu's SYL Hotel, the target of several previous attacks. Witnesses said police officers arrived at the hotel within minutes of the attack, triggering a fierce gun battle. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack in a brief statement. Al-Shabaab has been waging war against the internationally backed federal government for more than 16 years. A senior U.S. delegation, including Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Molly Fee and General Michael Langley, the commander of U.S. Africa Command, has met with Niger's ruling military junta. The State Department said discussions included Niger's return to a democratic path and the future of the two countries' security and development partnership. David Monda, professor of political science at the City University of New York, explained the meeting to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The U.S. is using two prongs, two different avenues in its interaction with Niger right now. One is the diplomatic and the other is the military. And as a result, we see a representative of the State Department there and also a representative of the Defense Department. But what that also says is that the U.S. is trying to use its diplomatic tools to try and reestablish democracy and dialogue within the country, given that it's now led by a military government. But on the other hand, the U.S. has strategic and military concerns in Niger, which is part of the reason why we have the head of the U.S. Africa Command also present.
The junta took a hard line against former colonial power France, forcing the withdrawal of French troops in place for nearly a decade. Niger's military, which has worked closely with the United States, has not demanded a similar pullout of U.S. forces. How do you explain that?
Number one, a historical memory that in Niger and in the Sahel more broadly and in Francophone Africa, we tend to see this wave of anti-French resentment where countries are now reclaiming their full sovereignty. And this is part of the situation we see with why France was being asked to leave from Niger by the Nigerian authorities. We saw a similar situation in Mali also with the ambassador being expelled, but the U.S. representative have been left. So this tells us that the Nigerians are actually realigning their strategic partners in terms of de-emphasizing France, but re-engaging with the United States. And now it looks that the U.S. will continue to play an even bigger role in terms of the domestic and security interests of Niger going forward.
ECOWAS leaders had agreed to lift economic sanctions against the Republic of Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Guinea. Following the ECOWAS agreement, Nigerian president has directed the opening of Nigeria's land and air borders with the Republic of Niger and the lifting of other sanctions against the country. What message would these developments send to coup leaders in Africa?
I think it sends the message that coups are okay, that coup leaders can get away with democratic backsliding, military leaders can get away with bad behavior. Because we see in Niger, where an elected civilian government, it has been overthrown by a military junta, and it seems that military junta is now being rewarded by sanctions being removed. In terms of the coup leaders, it also shows them, secondly, that if they band together, they can get away with unconstitutional and illegal acts like coup d'etat. In the case of Niger, we saw Niger get together with Mali and Burkina Faso in the Association of Sahel States. So they banded together together as rogue actors within ECOWAS, and they were actually able to overcome the threats of intervention from ECOWAS. But I think lastly, it really raises big questions about the norms and democratic ideals that ECOWAS as an association and Nigeria as the heavyweight in the region, whether ECOWAS really stands by its norms, because democratic governance, human rights, and the rule of law are at the center of the ECOWAS charter. And in this case, we see the Niger military actually misbehaving, going against those regional norms, but they're now being rewarded by sanctions being removed. I think one other point I'd also like to add is with Ramadan, there's also a bright light, even though these actions might appear to be rewarding the military dictators, because many times we know when countries are hit with sanctions, it's not the elites that suffer, it's not the military leaders, it's the poorest of the poor. So also in another element, I think removal of these sanctions from Niger will actually ease the pressure on the poorest in the population, because during this holy month of Ramadan, they'll be able to access, you know, basic goods and services that in many cases became out of their reach because of the sanctions.
Professor Monda, David, talking to VOA's Mohamed El-Chenawi. South Africa and Zimbabwe have signed a deal to share infrastructure to supply water to communities in both countries. Darren Taylor has the report.
The town of Musina on the South African side of the border with Zimbabwe is a good example of the country's current water woes. For the past few years, the local municipality hasn't supplied residents with regular water, and taps are often dry. This, despite the presence of the Limpopo River, one of South Africa's and Zimbabwe's major waterways. Musina's water crisis, like many in South Africa, is blamed on the local municipality's failures, and the Vembe Council has said it is partly responsible for water shortages. South Africa's Water Department Director General, Sean Phillips, says his office has pressed the municipality to provide better water services by repairing broken equipment and leaking reservoirs.
We've also been encouraging the district municipality to partner with private sector partners in the area, which they've been doing to some extent to assist with getting the existing infrastructure in better condition. But that alone is not sufficient, because the problem is that this is a very dry area of the country, and at the moment there simply isn't enough water to meet the demand.
But while Musina has run dry because of equipment breakdowns and power cuts, the Zimbabwean town of Bayat Bridge, just a few kilometers away, has been oversupplied with water. Unlike in South Africa, Bayat Bridge's waterworks are fully functional. In Musina, officials signed an agreement yesterday to share water and infrastructure. Among those signing was Zimbabwe's minister in charge of water, Anxious Masuka.
So I'm very pleased on behalf of Zimbabwe that this day has come to fruition. It has taken years of negotiation, and I thank the technical teams for having put the very best for their countries to ensure that we come to this level today. Zimbabwe is committed to supplying the maximum 15 million cubic meters of treated water per year to Musina town, and we hope this contribution will alleviate the water challenges, but also contribute to economic development of this region.
Former South African water chief Dr. Mike Muller tells VOA the agreement is an excellent practical example of how neighbors can cooperate to the mutual benefits of both.
Here you're talking about two communities, one on one side of the river, another on the other side. They share the same river. That's where they get their water from. But, you know, does it make sense for Bayat Bridge to build a water treatment works and, you know, get all the money spent there, and then Musina doing the same thing? And what's happened here is there's been a discussion about where the water can best be produced. And it was agreed that if Bayat Bridge in Zimbabwe, if they could expand their water works, South Africa could, in fact, just take water from them and avoid having to build and expand water works on the Musina side.
The deal isn't charity, though. South Africa will be paying Harare for its water, although the governments have yet to reveal amounts involved. Quoted in Zimbabwe's Herald newspaper recently, Zimbabwe Information Minister Jenfan Muswere said the country would benefit greatly from much-needed foreign currency. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Mokwedi Abaro, and our engineer, Patrick Deya, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.